My name is Bill Shelley, and I am a fanzine publisher, or was. However, my fanzine, Sense and Wonder, was not a groundbreaking fanzine. But what we have for you today are the editors and publishers of some genuinely groundbreaking fanzines. And as a matter of fact, this is, I think, a historic aggregation. I don't think these people have ever been on this panel together, a panel together in this exact aggregation.
I don't think I've ever met Richard Clark.
Okay. Well,
oh, really?
Seriously, senior moment.
Before we go on, I want to mention that tomorrow we will have a panel of Fandom's founders in this same room at 10 a.m. But today we are going to concentrate on the fanzines. And the founders they are, it's fanzines today. So let's get on with the introductions here. Starting with the people closest to me, we've got Roy Thomas, who with Jerry Bales launched the fanzine Alter Ego in 1961. And with us representing Jerry is his wife of 38 years, Jean Bales. Next, we have the editor of a fanzine called Wonder World, that started out actually as Graphic Story World, who invented the terms graphic story and graphic novel in 1964, Mr. Richard Kyle. Then we have the panelist who, though he has had a few other accomplishments over the years, will always be remembered for publishing the comic Reader, Paul Levitz. Never heard of that. And of course, we have the editors of the fanzine Zero, which first appeared in September of 1960, Richard and Pat Lipoff. And last but certainly not least, we have one of the editors of fanzine comic art, which debuted in spring of 1961, Maggie Thompson. Okay, well, I think that any fanzine story should begin, just like any good comic book story, with an origin. So I'd like to ask the panelists, and let's start with Maggie on the end, and talk about how your fanzine got started. How did comic art, before it existed, and what happened to make it exist?
I met my late husband, Don, at a science fiction picnic in 1957. And one of the things we talked about all that day was comics. But it was sort of, well, who does comics and they're sort of anonymous and what the heck is that all about? And among the other attendees at that picnic was Ed Hamilton, who wrote a huge number of my mom was a science fiction writer, whom you've never heard of. But it meant that I was a part of the world of science fiction for years. And so we had visited Ed Hamilton and Lee Brackett at their home, and he had a whole bunch of comic books on his wall, all the Superboys and things that he had written. Don and I talked about comics, among other things. The first contact that we had after we had spent that day talking was he sent me in a number 10 envelope, a folded over comic book. He said, I don't know if you've seen this, but you might find it interesting, and it was Humbug number 1. So I mean, it actually was an initial contact that way, but it wasn't until 1960, Worldcon in Pittsburgh, that the costume competition involved, among other people, the two sitting next to me here. I'm sure you can imagine them now, heroically standing, Captain Marvel and Mary Marvel. Beautiful costumes, really gorgeous. Homemade, oh yes, you couldn't buy factory made at that point. And so the next night was the banquet. And we sat there with Hal Lynch and Bill Failing, science fiction fans. Bill was also a pulp dealer. And looked around and said, what is it with comics and who writes them and who draws them? And by the way, what about magazine cartoons? And what about animated cartoons? And do newspaper strips? And who does all that? And do the people who sign their names, Walt Disney, really do the comic books? And so that fall, we sent out a one-page flyer to all the science fiction fans we knew addresses for and said, we're going to do this amateur magazine about comic books. We didn't say amateur magazine, we said fancy. We're going to do a fanzine about comic books, if you care, etc. Bill Thalen put us in contact with the Lupoffs, and that spring, it was comic book time. It was comic book fan time, because there had been other little bitty starts, EC fandom, satire fandom, but there had not been an amateur magazine devoted to all aspects of comics, and there had not been an amateur magazine devoted to all aspects of capes and secret disguises and superpowers. And so virtually simultaneously, Alter Ego and Comic Art No. 1 came out. And our experience was in the science fiction world. Their experience, heaven knows, more power to Gene and to Jerry Vales, to Roy Thomas, to that little coterie who all by themselves hand grew their own publication. We had the example of others. They just were brave pioneers.
Right. The term fanzine, as I understand it, was invented in the late 30s or early 40s by a non-hearing fan named Louis Chauvenet.
Probably.
Yeah.
I did not know how to pronounce his name until this very moment.
I'm just making that up. I've read it. Well, you gave us a little preview, but let's have the Lupoffs tell us in a little more detail how Zero got started.
I have to claim credit as the world's first male seamstress. I made those costumes. The Captain Marvel suit was a set of men's long red underwear with a yellow lightning bolt that I cut out of a piece of cloth and stitched on. The golden sash was a yellow scarf that I borrowed from Pat. The golden boots were a pair of long yellow socks, no shoes under them. And the white cape was a pillowcase. That was the costume. And Pat's costume was essentially a man's long t-shirt with other accessories. Somebody took a photo of us in those costumes, and it has been circulating for the past 50 years.
I have a copy, but I don't know if I took it.
Charlie Brown took it.
Excellent. So he must have sent us a print. See how it works? This was the internet before the internet.
Charles Brown, the editor and publisher of Locus, took that picture. Right. He only confessed that to me about a week before his death. I got to come clean. But anyway, yeah, so we did this first issue of Zero. It was designed just for fun. And we were talking this morning over breakfast. I said, why did you write that article about Captain Marvel? And I said, because nobody else would. Nobody else was writing about comic books. There was a certain amount of literature about newspaper comic strips. Not a great deal even of that, but some. There were two or three books and an occasional newspaper feature about Skeezix or Smiling Jack or Dick Tracy. But nobody was paying any attention to comic books. I thought that this was a seriously overlooked area of popular culture. And as the late Link Carter used to say, if you want to read a book and it doesn't exist, you have to write it. And that's where the Call in Color for a Dime got its beginning. That's my story. Oh, one more. I'm sorry to take so much time. I remember that convention in 1960 in Pittsburgh. I had a stack of copies of the first issue of Zero in my arms. And I remember literally running down the hallway, chasing people, trying to get them to take the And I remember people running away from me. I don't know what one of those would be worth today. I imagine it would be substantial.
Yes.
Well, the reason I got into comics anyway is from a child. I always was raised by comics, not by my mother, but my father would always bring me the papers and read me the colored kids' comics, and then I would get onto comics. And when I was very little, my favorite wasn't a superhero. It was, who's the little girl?
Mary Jane
and Snickles. And when I was like a sub-teenager. I was 11. I was an only child. My parents had stopped giving me somebody to take, you know, be in the house in case I turned the fire on too quickly or stuff. And I'd run downstairs. I would leave the door unlocked.
Can you hear? Could you pull the mic a little closer?
Okay. I'd leave the door unlocked. I lived in Manhattan on 88th Street. It had elevators. It had elevator men in it and a doorman. And I would run downstairs, and right across the street was a stationery store, and I had my allowance, and I'd buy all the new comics, and I'd sneak upstairs. And one night I snuck upstairs, and the door was locked. I couldn't get in the door. Oh, my God. So I thought, oh, okay, don't panic. Go and see the elevator man. He knows who you are. He'll let you in. Well, it was my father who said, where have you been? I said, I've been out shopping. He said, shopping? There's plenty of food for you. Where have you been? And I showed him the comics. He said, okay, next time, please go get them before we go out to dinner, because I don't think it's a good idea, etc. Anyway, when I met Dick, comics was one big, huge thing that we had in common. And we both discovered that we loved Captain and Mary Marvel and Captain Marvel Jr.
Thank you. Next we have Paul Levitz, who took over the helm of a fanzine that started in 1961, The Comic Reader. Paul, tell us what it was like to come in later and try and do justice to that title.
Well, the origin for me begins with Maggie. I had seen a couple of fanzines, some of the earlier issues of the Comic Reader. It was in a period that it was called On the Drawing Board. But the only fan... No.
Sounds like it's on.
Yeah, that's
fine.
It's on? You got it?
Project.
Better?
Well,
Plan B. Don and Maggie's Newfangles, the successor to Comic Art, the skinnier successor, I guess, was the last remaining news magazine being published, and they were starting to have grown-up lives, I imagine, and were becoming preoccupied by that, but they didn't want to go to all the trouble of returning the nickels and dimes that we'd all sent. So they announced a year in advance that they were going to give up publishing. And you could subscribe to as many issues as were left if you hadn't fully paid up, but that was it. We're getting the hell out of it. Dodge. And I'm sitting around my living room, age 14, with my friend Paul Kupperberg, who was a year older, in Brooklyn, and we're sitting there saying, we're not going to know what's going on. And with the foolish courage that age permits, we scraped together $16, and we called Marvel, and we called DC, and got a little bit of information, and DC sent us one of the flyers for the newsstand dealers that had a couple of pictures of upcoming covers, and we put together an incredibly amateurish-looking magazine called Etc. that if I show young people today, they kind of inquire exactly how retarded we were. Of course, they're viewing it through the eyes of a world of desktop publishing, and we were using stone chisels and other such tools. Maggie and Don were kind enough to say some kind words about it. Never been entirely sure whether that was on the grounds of it looked okay, or just, oh, thank God, someone's doing it so we don't have to feel as guilty. So, you know, please send your money to them instead of begging us to stay in business. Attracted a few more subscribers. And then Mark Hannerfeld, who was, I guess, the sixth editor or fifth editor of the Comic Reader, and it had allowed it to lapse, was working as an assistant editor at DC, got to know him, and after I'd put out, I guess, about 6 months worth of issues. My friend Paul had copped out by that time. Mark came to me one day with this giant manila envelope full of coins and a stack of rubber-banded index cards and said, here, you're sort of already doing it. Why don't you take over the Comic Reader name and fulfill all this so I don't have to feel guilty about having all these nickels and dimes? And suddenly I was doing the Comic Reader, and I had you know, a real circulation, and it was a real fanzine.
Now, Richard, you started contributing to fanzines well before you launched your own, is that correct?
Yeah, in fact, if it hadn't been for Dick and Pat Lupoff, why, I wouldn't have done anything. Is this working? It doesn't.
Yeah, that one's going.
Pull it just a little closer.
pardon me. I was a great science fiction fan. I subscribed to several science fiction fan magazines or fanzines. And I read this review of Zero, which was a new science fiction fanzine, but it did have something about comics in it. And I suddenly realized that I was absolutely in love with comics and that I missed them. That I had forgotten now how many years it had been since the Comic Code Authority came in and landed comics into nowhere. But anyway, I sent a quarter off of whatever it was some phenomenally small amount of money, and I got this issue of Zero. It seemed like it was almost instantaneous, and I just fell in love with the magazine, quite aside from the comics material. Dick and Pat created a remarkable magazine. Forget a fanzine or anything. It's an absolutely remarkable magazine for its time because it embraced everything that became significant in pop culture and introduced a lot of it or helped to promote it from comic books to Robert E. Howard to the Fu Manchu stories, book reviews when science fiction was finally becoming serious and just terribly serious. And anyway, I started subscribing and I wrote a long letter, I think it must have been, to Dick about how much I enjoyed the magazine. And he asked me if I would write an article about the Fox comic books. And arranged to have a whole box of Fox comics sent to me. Well, the thing that he didn't really tell me about it was that unlike the other articles about comics from Jim Harmon and some others, that were they were not nostalgia, and for good reason. But the Fox comics came out, published about 6 months or less than a year, I think, under the original studio that produced comics, and became a really miserable magazine company. They were tightwads. They were thieves, literary thieves, but thieves. They were just despicable, and as the conditions of their magazines declined, well, they started publishing kind of sadomasochistic porno soft cover, but they started publishing that stuff, and these really were for little kids. I mean, you know, you really ought to consider your audience, and which Fox never did. He always believed that. He was a sharper, and he applied it to the publishing business. And so anyway, I wrote the story of, from beginning to end about taking out of this box of comics, from starting off very rather idealistically with beautiful artwork and ending it with wretched artwork and abominable stories. And that got me interested in comics.
That's quite a statement there.
Before that, I hadn't paid any attention to... I mean, I loved them, but I hadn't thought about them. You know, I hadn't given them any thought.
Dick has an interjection.
Yeah.
If I may. Richard Kyle is being too modest. He wrote this brilliant essay called The Education of Victor Fox. He sent us the manuscript. We typed up stencils, and somebody, I don't know who it was, stenciled illustrations to go with it. We ran them off, and the illustrations didn't come out very well. We sent Richard, in essence, a proof set, and he saw how badly we had done the artwork. So without saying anything to us, he personally retyped all the stencils, re-stenciled all the artwork, ran off however many copies, 150 or 200, whatever our circulation was, and mailed us his article, all set to be collated and stapled into the fanzine. And he never complained about it. He never played great credit or anything. He was just that dedicated to what he was doing.
I will tell you the reason, though, Dick, why I didn't complain any, and that's because I was responsible for screwing up the article of versions in the first place. I had no experience with mimeograph and with mimeograph sheets, and so I didn't know how you transferred halftones. And I had two ways to do it. It's really simple. You can do it the right way or you can do it the wrong way. And I chose the wrong way. So that's the reason that I went to all that trouble, was because it was my responsibility.
But Richard, let's jump ahead now. What inspired you to start Graphic Story World in late 1969?
Well, actually, Bill Spicer did somewhat earlier. He got in touch with me, I think, because my address was in Zero.
But I meant your own fans.
Well, that's it. He got in touch with me about it, and I knew nothing about the mechanics of printing, but Bill worked at the advertising, and he understood how to put a magazine together. I mean, make it look good, make it look professional. And so he was starting an amateur comic book called Fantasy Illustrated, and that eventually turned into Graphic Story Magazine, and I wrote a column about comics from kind of a serious, over-serious. I mean, I pressed a bit, you know. But pretended that I was an actual book reviewer reviewing books. And so with the knowledge and the help of Bill, I was then able to produce the copy for Graphic Story World magazine. But it was completely dependent upon Bill. If I hadn't run into him, I didn't know anything about printing, and I didn't want to do the mimeograph ones because I had discovered that was not my forte.
These are stories I've never heard before, so this is great. I don't know if there's a story about the founding of Alter Ego that I haven't heard before, but let's see if we can hear one. Roy, how about that?
Well, I don't know. I've probably told them all a million times. But we will do the short version. The basic thing was that I was writing letters to. I wrote just a handful of letters, really, by that stage, to Julius Schwartz, who was the. Well, actually, I wrote three letters the first time. I wrote one to the editor of Jude, Justice League of America, that had just come out. One to the editor of Flash, and one to the editor of Green Lantern. Of course, they all went to Julius Schwartz's desk, and he answered me. I hadn't bothered to check the indices. That would have taken too much, you know, maturity, I suppose, to figure out I was only about, you know, pushing 20. And he gave me Gardner Fox's home address. I had asked, you know, maybe, and he gave me the information, which I did not know, and almost no one did, that Gardner Fox had written many of the Justice Society stories that I was saying that I had liked so much years before. So therefore, he was writing Justice League. So I should maybe drop him a line if I wanted to try to get a hold of some old All-Star comics, which was partly what I wanted to do, as well as thanking him for his work. And he said, well, I sold mine a couple of years ago, the ones I had, the first 30 or so issues, by bound volumes, to this guy in, he was back in Kansas City, you know, and everything. But he now lives in Detroit. So I sent him a letter in early November or so, I guess it was, of 1960. I was just a couple of weeks away from turning 20. And I got a letter back a few days later from Dr. Jerry G. Bales of Wayne State University in Detroit, who was a whole, like, 7 years older than I was. And he had just moved there to start his teaching career, and was also a fellow Missourian and a huge All-Star Comics fan, obviously a few years longer than I had been, had got these comics. And along with it, he said, well, you know, as long as he had them lying around, he sent me a little present, just stuff he didn't get, you know, ever get around to throwing away. It was the semi-complete, and one of them was complete, a fourth, fifth, and sixth issues of All-Star Comics, you know. And the fifth one was totally complete and in good condition. The others were incomplete. But, you know, this was the first I had seen of these things. I hadn't really known the history. I didn't know Green Lantern and Flash had been members and then kicked out and then back again and all this stuff. So I became fascinated. And we exchanged a lot of letters. We were enthusiastic. And Jerry had this idea for a six-inch guy called the Atom that he had already sent a letter to Julia Schwartz about, which Julia always later claimed he didn't remember. But somehow they got a six-inch Atom at DC out of it. And at some stage or other. This was right before my 20th birthday. And just a couple of months later, a weird accident happened that Jerry got invited, I think this was important. Jerry got invited to speak at a Long Island, New York college. So he thought he'd use that excuse to just drop by the D.C. offices and meet Julia Schwartz and maybe a couple of these other people. And at that time, he sort of, at the same time, began to think about doing a newsletter on Spirit Duplicator, which is about a step down from Mimeograph. You know, that's really primitive stuff. And it was going to be called, he finally had a great name for it, the JLA Newsletter, because the idea was to encourage people to subscribe to Justice League so it would be a big hit. And he also wanted to get Justice League done as a big comic with separate chapters like the old All-Stars. By the time he came back from New York, he had come up with the name Alter Ego, is the hyphenated word. He never told me how he arrived at it. It was just a perfectly wonderful title. And Julia Schwartz, he had already had the idea before going of the JLA newsletter, and it just expanded. And one of the things that expanded it was that Julie showed, being an old science fiction fan since the 30s, if not the 20s, Julie had shown him several fanzines. I'm not sure if it was anything besides the first two or three issues of Zero. It was probably just that. And of course, they had the comic book article in it, and I think that the more I thought at various times, I thought, well, you know, Jerry already had the idea. But on the other hand, once he saw the issues of Zero, the idea, it went from a newsletter to a fanzine, a term that neither he nor I had ever, or 99.9% of the American public had never heard. And so we should do this. And then he loaned me the copies of, Julie's copies of Zero. And they were a big influence. I think that later on, of course, Don and Maggie were already working, before Jerry and I were, on Alter Ego. It came out maybe a week later, but it was actually in the works, you know, rather longer. And it was a whole separate. Ours was all based on the superhero, the revival of the superhero, and reminiscing about the old ones from the 40s and so forth. And we were open to other things, but it was mostly about the superhero and gradually expand into other areas. And of course, Don and Maggie had a different franchise, which was everything. So together, we sort of, you know, covered a lot of territory. But the more I think of it as time goes on, and it does have a way of doing that, the more I realize, even more than I did before, how much Alter Ego owed to Zero, and then even later to comic art after it came out, because those were always the standards when I was writing or editing. Those were the standards that I was trying to reach for, because I considered both of them and Zero, with its broad reach of science fiction, popular culture, and so forth, really to be just one of the most extraordinary publications that I ever ran into, and I still believe that. And they were very influential on Alter Ego, and then Alter Ego, in turn, was influential on a bunch of other fanzines, and eventually it helped launch me into a comic career, so it did all right for everybody, I guess.
Thanks, Mike. One of the things about Alter Ego was it was designed to promote comics fandom and to get fans together, to bring them together, to support not only the Justice League, but the whole Silver Age of comics that was happening. And I want to ask Gene Bales here, what was Jerry's relationship like with the fans? I mean, he obviously valued their input, he wanted to bring them together.
Okay, I met Jerry mostly when he had finished his fanzines involvement. He had handed them off to other people before I met him. Or maybe during, I'm not sure. Anyway, but he had, he didn't talk too much to me about fanzines, but I know we had to sneak off at night and go down to the university and use Mimeograph, probably for the panel he says, don't tell anybody.
And, well, I think, Gene, you were listed as a co-editor of the Panelologist.
Yeah, well, he listed me on a lot of things that I really didn't have a lot to do with. Except, you too? Okay, well, I enabled him to do what he did. And pretty soon he went into Who's Who after Pansy. And I just find out until recently that while I was volunteering in Mexico, that he had sent out things to his fans and saying that this would be it for him, comics fandom, and he wouldn't be in it anymore. And I don't know why he did that, because I thought it was cool. I enjoyed conventions. I enjoyed Alter Ego. But he didn't talk too much about his fanzines. What he did talk about was his fans, and he had three things in mind. One was a strong desire to bring back the Justice Society.
I heard that, yeah.
Did you hear that? And one was to make comics more fan-friendly. As a consumer group, to have the numbers and the pressure to have editors do whatever fans wanted. And then the third thing was to get fans themselves involved with critics. So Jerry was a very private kind of person, but he did have people over and look at their portfolios and told them who he should talk to in New York for some of the editors to get a job, and I guess he made recommendations. And that's why a lot of people from Detroit got involved in comics and as pros coming from fandom.
Thank you. Jerry, of course, is somebody who should be on this panel if he's with us now. We're happy to have Gene. Likewise, Don Thompson is somebody who we miss very much. He actually had conceived, now tell me if I'm wrong, Maggie, I believe he had conceived the idea of starting a comics fandom in a conversation in 1960, in a conversation with Hal Lynch. Is that correct?
Yes, that was the banquet that followed the, it was the day after the costume competition, and he was a member of the science fiction fan club at Penn State University, and they were doing a science fiction fanzine called Ballast, because the last thing you need on a spaceship is ballast. And the idea being, well, the way you find out about something is to find out people who know about it and spread the word and so forth. So yes, we did not get zero at the Pittsburgh convention, but Bill Thaling, who was seated at that table with Hal Lynch and us, recommended zero to us, and we managed to get a copy of the first issue because he had not distributed all of them at the convention, and we thought it was fantastic. By the way, another note about zero that hasn't been mentioned is it won a Hugo Award for being the best fanzine with its final issue. And we, in fact, rode in your car from Washington, D.C. to New York with Phil Serrell sitting in the back seat of the car. Now, I want you to imagine this. This was a convertible. So it was an open convertible. We were driving along, and a fan named Phil Harrell was seated in the back seat with their Hugo, polishing it. Now, the Hugo is shaped like a giant spaceship. But one of the things you need to know about Zero is that we pay attention to it because here were the origins of comics fandom. But by golly, I mean, the contributors to Zero by that last issue, they were professional writers, they were editors taking readers behind the scenes, what was going on in science fiction, what was going on in popular culture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the only way you could get a copy was if you contributed to it in some way, wrote a letter of comment or whatever. So people kept trying to buy copies, and it was too good to be sold for mere money. I need to point that out. But yes, it was because it was comic book time. We wanted to find out about it. We knew a bunch of false stories, and then we sent it to, I mean, obviously there's an address for the DC Comics, so we would send it in, and at one point, Julie Schwartz said to us, having popularized Alter Ego and telling, giving readers the address and here's where you can contact, he offered us the same deal. We said, for heaven's sake, no. We lost money. It was the old gag, you know, we lost money on every issue, but we made up for it in volume. We didn't need the volume.
By the way, am I wrong, Pat, or are you the first woman to ever win a Hugo? I think that's true. How did that happen?
Well, I won the Hugo because I did...
because you're the co-editor.
I'm the co-editor, and I guess I was I was completely blown by that. I didn't think much of it. I thought, well, I won because Dick and I... had fun doing
it's almost hard to believe.
Fancy.
But that's amazing. You're a pioneer there.
I suppose so.
And she ran one of the great letters columns of any publication around there. She had wonderful people in it, and to keep it going, it was really a wonderful thing to read that letters page. That was one of the first things I turned to when the issue came in.
Thank you.
Dick?
My favorite letter that we ever received was from a very, very politically active fan named Art Castillo.
Art Castillo,
take your pick. Who took us to task for wasting good paper and ink on trivial things like popular culture instead of making revolution. And he accused us of publishing a fanzine of relativistic Dadaism.
Okay.
I was so enchanted with that phrase that we adopted it as our official slogan. Zero, the fanzine of relativistic Dadaism.
As a matter of fact, if you've seen in the program guide the feature on fanzines, that's the issue we reproduce of Zero. That has that slogan on the cover by the very IP. Okay, well, why don't we go ahead then and talk about, we can't talk about all the wonderful things that we could get into in detail, but let's start with Roy this time. Let's talk about the feature of your fanzine that most exemplified it. What do you think was the thing about Alter Ego that was most central to its appeal or its mission or whatever? I mean, you had the slogan, right?
Brian Foss called it the comics of the past, present, and future. I guess we were sort of that, but you know, we were interested in the comics that were coming out then. I've kind of got rid of that aspect of it in recent years. Interested in comics of the present, got rid of that for the most part, which now we just deal in the past. There's plenty of that to go around. I think the thing that was of the most interest was the article about comic books. They weren't reprinting many of them then, maybe, you know, a couple of Batmans or Supermans. So the whole point, and this started with Dick Lupoff's The Big Red Cheese, which, you know, popularized that phrase. I didn't even remember that as being what Dr. Savannah called Captain Marvel, but of course it was. And nowadays, everybody who knows of the character at all has learned that phrase. And reading those several articles and then the others as they came out, about the time that I started seeing Don Thompson had written his article on Timely Comics, which a little phrase called, it used the title, Okay, Axis, Here We Come. I think I borrowed that from somewhere later on. And I think the thing that was the great thing for me was the just covering the whole comic company, however it was done, whether it was Richard Kyle's, you know, almost, you know, analysis or just recounting the stories with a certain amount of cleverness, like Dick and Jim Harmon on Justice Society, Ted White, people like that, just doing a nice job of that. So wherever we started, that was the thing that I was always interested in. When I started off, okay, I drew this Bestest League stuff and I wrote a Spectre thing, but what I really was interested in were the articles about the old comics. I had to write an article about All Winners. I was the leader from Justice Society, so I decided to write an article about the All Winners squad, but all I had was one of the two comics. And it was missing the last two pages of one chapter, so I had to sort of, well, I don't know how, some editor got rid of the tidal wave. And Jerry typing it spelled it tidal wave, T-I-T-A-L, so, you know, but it took me like 5 or 10 years before I got a copy of that book to learn to complete the article. So that was the thing that I liked the most about the articles. And you know, those standards gradually improved. We were always trying to get up to the standards of the article, that were in Comic Art and Zero and so forth. And finally, I finally changed a little with the article when I took over as editor and publisher with number 7 and drove over to Bill Joe White, wonderful comic artist, house over in this little block house with early complete runs of Batman, Superman, Captain Marvel, all that stuff. And I'd go in there and just make a lot of notes on just mostly the Marvel Family comics and so forth. And I wrote the article, One Man's Family, taking the title for an old radio show, and wrote this article. I couldn't do a thing just about Captain Marvel because Dick Lubov had done that, so I said, I'll write about the family and sort of cover the whole group and do it from that angle. And that was my type of thing. Nowadays, you read these articles, and, you know, they don't amount to that much because... you know, you could go and read the whole comic. But at that time, that was kind of the essence. Let people know what was actually in these comics. The one thing you didn't have nearly enough of, but that Jerry wanted from the very beginning, I know, and so would I have, but he especially, was to cover the professionals. Because when he was there at the very beginning, during that meeting with Julie Schwartz and at that time in early 61, February of 61, when he was there, one of the first things he was doing was trying to press Bill Finger, who I guess he ran into there, and of course Gardner Fox, Bill Finger to write him, and he got a promise of an autobiography, which of course Bill never delivered, as he did not deliver many things that he did. But the idea was to try to give some credit to these anonymous people working, you know, behind the scenes, and then to get people to know who Gardner Fox was and Bill Finger was and so forth. And those were the things that we were always trying to stress. And to some extent, if you want to read about Zero, by the way, you know, I only get a couple of pennies on this, so I'm not just hopelessly shilling, but if you pick up a copy of our Alter Ego number 18, I guess it was, Bill Shelley and I put together a whole 30 or 40 page section about Zero, and I'm proud to say that we reprinted the entire 2 postcards from Art Castillo, because I too thought that those 2 postcards, first one, and then after you printed them in the magazine, I guess he got upset, you know, because you weren't taking him seriously. So he sent in another one. And he says, a whole world of it fermenting and so forth. And you get people sit on your ass and discuss comic books. I just thought that was the funniest thing in the world and everything. I thought, this. And that was the feel that I think all of us in our own ways, we were trying to puncture and mostly just ignore.
Well, you know, Jerry's life mission of being about giving recognition to the creators of comics was his who's who. And so that obviously was very high priority even from the beginning. Now, Richard, when you did Wonder World, the first issue had a manifesto about the coming of the graphic novel and the graphic story. Was that your mission with Wonder World?
You know, I haven't really any clear idea. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, I really don't have a clear idea of why I became so intensely interested in comics. But apparently, it was the times. Maggie talked about being Comics Con. And I was part of Comics Con. And the comics didn't grow up the way I had. I mean, you know, I was 12 years old, and I was a natural comic book reader. Then I became 13, and they were suspicious of me up in the publishing houses, and by the time I was 15 or 16, I was a nut. They didn't want me buying their magazines. You know, only an idiot would read this stuff if you were grown up. And my argument was that if you do a magazine for 5-year-olds, you get 5-year-old readers. And if you do a magazine for 82-year-olds, I'm 82, well, you're going to get an 82-year-old reader. And that the mistake that the comic book people were doing, aside from taking away my pleasure in reading this great stuff, was because they just didn't recognize ordinary economic fact. It maddened me. they simply would do something that any other business would normally do. I mean, if you go out and sell a car that's one design that sells real well, well, then you design another one also and see how it sells. But the comic book industry never did it. They were the single most blind company in a supposedly capitalistic society that I can imagine. But I really have no idea beyond the fact that I was just convinced that, come on, you can do stuff for me, you can do stuff for people my age. And I kind of overdid it. Reading some of that stuff now is a little embarrassing, but I felt, I felt that way at the time. I was being sincere, even if I didn't express it all that well.
And you were right. that's also.
Oh, that's kind of horrible. Isn't that a bad thing right there?
Well, now, Paul, what was the mission of the comic reader, and tell us about that, please.
Well, I think the comic reader from its beginnings had been news-focused, news and gossip. There was very little information about what was going on in the business. And Mark Hanerfeld, during his tenure, I think, was the first fanzine editor to manage to talk one of the comic book companies into announcing the release dates of upcoming issues in advance. He got those out of DC. Now, I don't think he was able to get any of that out of Marvel at that time. Over the 3 years that I did the book, we managed to get to the point where, thanks to Roy and some of the other former fans who were working at Marvel, Nelson Bridwell, some of the other former fans, Mark Wolfman, Mark Hanerfeld, who were around DC, we had pretty much the full release schedule for everybody who was publishing comics, at least of the comics that, as a 14, 15, 16-year-old kid, I thought counted. Fairly narrow definition at that stage. Some stuff on the Gold Key material and the Western material, but I was fairly ignorant of Karl Barks' work and the importance of it in those years, because I'd outgrown all that stuff. It's not as serious. But what made that important, I think, and what really connected it, heard about Jerry's great passion for the recognition of these people. At the time I was doing the comic reader, probably 90% of the people working in comics lived within about 30 to 40 miles of New York City. Very small group of people in America, maybe 200 people, perhaps, best I could count on my fingers. And the publishers were still just beginning to recover from what Richard mentioned about the blandization of the comics code. But it was more than the blandization. It was also the trauma. And the publishers didn't, in most cases, credit the writers and artists. Marvel was ahead of the pack at that time. Stan had started the idea of branding the books more regularly, picked up on some stuff that EC had done before, but took it up to the next natural level. DC didn't have credits on probably two-thirds of the line, Western on almost nothing. They didn't even tell people when their work was coming out or give them copies. The editors at DC, for example, would get 15 copies of each new issue, even of an anthology comic that might perhaps have 8 or 9 creators, and usually didn't even bother mailing any to the creators, because the assumption was, why the hell would you actually want a file copy of something you've written for a comic book? You'd be embarrassed by it anyway. And the comic reader became the first place where even the creators in the business knew where their work was coming out, so they could go run over to Ed Summers' Super Snipe, one of the first comic shops in New York, and reserve copies of their own books so they could actually have a copy of it. Or see something that often told them for the first time that they were being fired off an assignment because the editor hadn't had the courage to pick up the phone and call them. A tradition that continued for many years, even when some of us were in positions of authority working in comic book companies, we didn't necessarily manage to instill editors with the appropriate level of courage to always do that the right way. But that kind of information became very, very important to people. And to the rank and file fan, you could find out what was coming out because it was a shock. And it still was somewhat random. I have very clear memories of the surprise of finding Savage Tales suddenly on the newsstand, completely unannounced, even though I was one of the people who was in the know. But the black and white magazine business was at the edge of Marvel's. This was a strange little experiment. For most of the people, there was just no information fandom about the present. Until the present moved into the past, it didn't count. And the comic reader was sort of the first thing that was beginning to edge into the future. And I think that's why it achieved a solid circulation when I managed to get that information out every month on a fairly regular basis.
You know, you talk about information. When fans in the early 60s started looking for information, there wasn't any. And I think probably All in Color for a Dime was the beginning of fans trying to chronicle comics in the past. Dick or Pat, would you feel that that's the main feature of Zero? Or how would you characterize All in Color for a Dime in Zero's history?
It is certainly the one that Zero was best known for, but we were... When we started out, Pat and I were young married. We were a couple of young married science fiction fans, and we started this as a hobby. We thought that it was a science fiction fanzine, but in fact it wasn't. It was more of a general, broad screen journal of popular culture. We had articles about comics, about films, even about theater. People in different areas will zero in on you and they'll remember something that you did 30 or 50 years ago and say, did you ever do anything? I was at a Burroughs convention a few years ago and somebody came up to me with my very first book, a book about Edgar Rice Burroughs from 1965. Here it was 40 years later. He had this beautiful, pristine, mint copy, wanted an autograph. And then he said to me, did you ever write anything else? So people in the comics world think of Zero as a comics fanzine, but that was only one facet of it. But I do want to mention one thing about bringing recognition, which was what Roy had talked about so much, bringing recognition to a lot of these important creators, writers, and artists. I know, for instance, Fawcett had a policy against putting bylines on any of their comics, so that Clarence Beck used to sneak the initials OOB, for Otto O. Binder, into Captain Marvel's stories. There would be a book on a shelf, and you'd see on the spine of it, OOB. And this was Clarence Beck's way of saying, Otto Binder wrote this story, because the management wouldn't let them put their name on it. They didn't want any identification with individual creators. They only wanted the company to be known.
Well, Maggie, with comic art, why don't you fill us in on that?
Well, I just wanted to speak to one aspect of that and the incredible tasks that Jerry Bales undertook with the Who's Who, because, yes, just tracking anything down was a nightmare. My mother always thought that Johnny Gruhl did all the Raggedy Ann and Andy comics because his name appeared on them, and of course he had died before comics were published at all. I wanted to mention that what fans had to contend with back in those days was the kindness of an editor who might forward a fan letter. So that, for example, when my mother discovered after 7 days of reading the Pogo stories in Animal Comics to me every night, that on the seventh day it was as much fun as it was the first, and she wrote a fan letter to Walt Kelly, the editor to whom she had sent it, to the editorial office's address, actually forwarded it to Kelly, so they became lifelong friends. The flip side to that was, well, it's not the flip side, it was the kindness of an editor who took it upon himself to forward a fan letter to Carl Barks, who had to sign all his work Walt Disney, but who forwarded that letter to Carl Barks, who thought it was a joke. And then he got a second letter And Mal Willits, I believe, was the author of that first letter. I believe we were the authors of the second letter. Yeah. So years later, when we were putting together our final issue, maybe I'll do another issue of Comic Art. It was an irregular schedule. You never know. I might do another issue someday. when we were putting together that last issue, we wanted to cover feature the work of Carl Barks. And we wrote to Disney and asked for permission to reproduce some samples of Carl Barks' artwork. And the letter we received back was, not only do we not give you permission to reproduce any of his artwork, we want to discourage in the strongest possible terms you writing any sort of article on this at all, because the children of America believe that Walt Disney draws his comic books, and we do not want to upset the children of America. And then Walt Disney died. And newspapers around the country took the opportunity to drop things like duck panels and so forth, because, well, of course he couldn't do it anymore because he died. And we were given permission to reproduce that art. But it was that sort of struggle in that day. Absolutely.
Well, we've got about a half hour left, really a little bit less. So I think really we should cut to the questions, don't you? Let's do some Q&A.
So one of the other important fanzines, you guys are talking a lot about the 60s, and a beautiful fanzine that introduced me to fandom was the RBCC, the Rockets Plaza Comic Collector. And for a whole bunch of us, I think it's important for two reasons. First of all, they did the astonishing thing, either Gordon Love or Jim Van Heist, I don't know who it was, of advertising in the comics that this fanzine existed. And so I found that, and then I found fandom. But the other thing is, they had our version of Wikipedia, which was Don Rosa's Information Please, which was amazing. And I wonder if you guys have any recollections about RBCC or that magazine and your thoughts about it.
Well, I was certainly aware of it, but I had no particular contacts with it. And someone else, I'm sure, will do a lot better job answering that question than I would.
Well, I share Dick's feelings. I was not really a collector ever. And a book that primarily advertised comics just wasn't particularly interesting to me, but I was aware that it was influential and with artists and promoted quite a number of really major artists.
Well, partly it was another thing that Jerry Vale did, because the Comic Collector, that name with this one word, was it the very first issue of Alter Ego or something? And of course he made that his, after two or three issues, he started with the first ad-zine, which was all stuff he couldn't run an Alter Ego because it wasn't coming out often enough, so he wanted to get in there and advertise his own comics and get things. He started that, and then he took another department from Alter Ego on the drawing board, which was in the first issue, and he turned that into a magazine, which became the Comic Reader. So Jerry was sort of like Johnny Appleseed of all this thing. And G.V. Love took that together and made it really a very influential. It was always crude, but it had everything in there, you know, and it had its enthusiasm. It was a very important magazine.
There were some predecessors. Jimmy Teresi did Fantasy Collector and did, I believe, at least one issue devoted to comic books back in the day. But when you consider the handicaps that Love faced in producing what he did, the accomplishments were extraordinary.
He suffered from cerebral palsy, and he would have to type one finger at a time, and I think he had to grip a pencil and hit it with an eraser. Now, if you think about that, that's pretty amazing. Buddy, we have Buddy Saunders here. You got a question, Buddy?
Started as Rockets Blast, just a fanzine. There was no advertising at all, and I don't know how many issues it went, but there was before it became Comic Collector, or I joined, and then there was another publication called Comic Collector that was the ad zine,
yes.
And then those two merged. But even after they merged, I've never thought of Rockets Blast as primarily an ad zine. And they had lots of articles, lots of artwork stories.
Speaking of artwork, you did the covers for about 10 of those first issues, I believe.
Yeah, I was the, I don't know what my title was. I was the chief artist for Rockets Blast for a while.
I
teenagers who was writing fanzines and publishing fanzines in the
Speak.
I remember I came in with Rocket Boy as a comic collector in around 1966 and started publishing fanzines in 67 and 68. I also got into science fiction fan about the same time. And so I was, to me, all of the fans from the early 60s were like, the adults were older than me, and I was a young teenager, so I was fascinated by my forebears. And so I learned as much as I could from the science fiction side. And once, and in 69, I put in my fanzine, I was writing saying how comics fandom evolved out of science fiction fandom as an offshoot. I got a very indignant letter from one of my esteemed forebears, Jerry Beckles, saying, we didn't, I came up with science with comics fandom. Secondly, I didn't know about science fiction fandom, and chiding all around on my air.
Doug published a fanzine called Comicology in the late 60s. Let's go with the questions of the panel.
In the back, right there.
A question for Roy. Just recently I was looking at Who's Who in comic fandom, and I just wondered at the time, Roy, if you realized how many of the people that were in there were actually not American.
We're not what?
Not from the USA. There were fans, you had Ryan, from Australia, and other people in there from the UK, and people from far and wide.
You're talking about the artists and writers in the Who's Who?
Of comic fandom.
Oh, the fans in 1964 where Jerry listed all of 1,600 fans.
Did you realize at the time how widespread you guys were?
No, I never paid attention to this stuff. I was just busy, you know, writing, drawing, and doing things. And Jerry was the organizer. You know, he was the guy that did all this. I was never really the editor or co-editor of Alter Ego in anything except name until the 7th issue when I took it over. Other than that, I just contributed stuff. But I was aware of two people, I think, outside the state. John Wright in South Africa and John Ryan in Australia. And I think I exchanged at least a
Gary Mason. Right. Gary Mason also in Australia. But let me mention...
But I only knew those two guys. That was all I knew about.
But John Wright was important because he was in South Africa. Those of us who did mimeographed fanzines didn't care, but the folks doing the Ditto fanzines, you could only get yellow Ditto masters from South Africa.
And Terry Bales was the American agent for the comics, which was John Wright's fanzine.
Yeah, I think, let me add just one other piece. Sure. It's also important to just note kind of the viral nature of how this all bred when you talk about the international side. You've heard from the panel how unintentionally all these things come out of the same family tree. But that continued to happen internationally. Even when I was doing the Comic Reader, I had two guys from foreign fanzines write me asking for permission to reprint the news, like I owned the news. One was a fanzine called Comic Media in the UK. One of the two principals of that is a man named Nick Landau, who went on to found Forbidden Planet and Titan Books with their enormous stand downstairs. And in the same fashion, they were passing back tons of information on Modesty Blaze and things that came more out of the UK tradition. The other was a man named Karsten Sondergaard from Scandinavia. I have no memory of how to pronounce the fanzine that he was reprinting my material in. I had a draw full of incomprehensible editions of it. And I discovered, I don't know, 20 years later, that he ended up as the reprint editor for Semic for Superman in Scandinavia. All of this, in this pre-internet era, most of what is going on now in the internet world with whether it was use groups or the contact points, really is a funhouse mirror of what was going on in the fanzine world. With none of the technology available to us, we built our own web. And whether it was because an editor listed something or because one fanzine editor plugged another fanzine or contacted it or connected it, this desire to be a part of each other's world led us to do all of these things, and it really was very, very far-reaching. I got an email 2-3 weeks ago from Germany from a man who was about to present my book an award at a Munich comic convention, and I think he's the one person I have a social relationship with in England because he was one of, in Germany because he was one of my subscribers going back that far. And here he was unimaginably connecting to it 40 years later.
I'd like to, we have a couple of housekeeping things we should mention before we do run out of time. One of them is that we have a fanzine editor here who came from Florida, and I'd like him to stand up, Bill Wilson, the collector.
It's amazing how much effect all of our work had that we didn't know about. But I'll give you two incidents that occurred in recent years. I was doing a little work for a radio station where I live, and we were interviewing authors as they came through town. And Art Spiegelman came through, the fellow who created Mouse. And he says, "You're Dick Lukoff?" And I said, "Yes, you're Art Spiegelman." I was very impressed. He says, "I used to send you sticky dimes and quarters to subscribe to Zero when I was a teenager." And then, a couple of weeks later, Michael Chabon, author of Cavalier and Clay, comes in. And he says, "When I was a little boy, I slept with a copy of All in Color for a Dime under my pillow."
I'd like to add one addition to that about Zero. There was a magazine back around 1930 called Story Magazine, and it started off as a mimeograph magazine, and then it became a fully printed professional magazine. It had Hemingway and all of the important writers of their times, and was incredibly influential, who subsequently became novelists and who subsequently became successful. It's an amazing book with initially a very tiny circulation. Zero was a magazine in terms of popular culture like that. And you only had a few hundred copies sold, or just a few hundred readers. But the effect on that was enormous. Roger Ebert contributed poetry.
Yes. He was our in-house poet.
Yes. It was really astonishing. I mean, to me, that was a signal publication of enormous importance, not only in the comics field or even in science fiction and so on, but in the world of popular culture. And I really honor you for that.
Let's have another question from over there.
Hi, I'm Larry Wigman. I'm one of the younger guys with Doug and Bill and Paul. And I just want to thank you all for doing this. As these guys mentioned, when I was a teenager in the mid-60s, got hooked up with the Rocket Splash, I grew up in Miami, and found out about these other fanzines. I could never get a hold of the Comic Art, could never get a hold of Zero. I've got them all now. But really what I wanted to bring up and ask you all about is, as the years went by and I just kept staying more and more in all these years or whatever, and I sold off almost all my comics. I still have all my fans because they meant that much to me, and the connections and the people I knew. But I have a few favorites of all of those old fans. And I'd just be interested in what yours are. I mean, just to put it out there, of that time, those classic 60s and the early 70s fans, in fact, the single fanzine that I can think of to start to finish, package, design, the content, was Graphic Story Magazine 10. Bill's oblong one, the Odie cover, and the long, incredible Alex Toth interview. I'd say second, to me, was Squadron number 3, Jerry Reese's fans. And then in terms of the article that still comes back to me, that meant so much to me, because as everybody said, there was no internet, didn't know what had come out before, aside from the few articles and fanzines. Ed Lahman did an article in Alterego number 5, where he just said, if you're really wanting to collect Golden Age comics, these are the ones you need to have. And he went to every company.
No.
Well, not every.
He forgot Quality Total.
That's right.
Which was actually his favorite comic company, and he liked it so much he forgot to include it totally. But other than that, it was a great article.
At that time, you couldn't find that sort of information. So again, just in terms of favorite issues of fanzines other than your own.
Anybody?
Yeah.
Amra was a fantastic fanzine. Incredible art, incredible coverage. I was a member of the Hyborian Legion. I'll have you know, my name is Yasmina Avencia. Just going on the record here. I'm just saying. Basically, you could take character names from Howard's material and adopt it as your own. And Yasmina Avencia, everybody wanted to be Belit, but I wasn't in line fast enough. And Yasmina told Conan to go stuff it. She's the one character who was not impressed with Conan, so I thought, all right, that works.
Just in case anybody in this hall doesn't know, that's a Robert E. Howard fan.
Sorry. Yeah, should have explained. So the outstanding issues there. That George Sithers was the editor, and it was fantastic.
With illustrations by Roy Krenkel, one of the great pen and ink artists. Yeah.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left. Should we ask have another question?
Can I just do a one-second Ed Lehman story? Because this audience will appreciate it. It's one of the best letters I ever received as publisher of DC. Ed would periodically, after batches of archives, write long letters of what we ought to publish again and again and again. And then finally he writes me a letter that says, it's probably the last one I'm going to send you because I'm about to go into a nursing home. But I just want to let you know I've made arrangements to keep my complete collection of DC archives going after I'm gone. I've essentially endowed my daughter with a fund to keep purchasing the archives, so this is all complete. So this is one fan who pretty much took it with him. I would also just like to make a plug to this group because there's probably more people with more cool fanzines in this room than we'll ever gather any other time. There's a woman wandering around the convention named Julia Ree, who is the librarian of the UC Riverside Library, which inherited Fred Patton's fanzine collection. And she would love to have anything that you're willing to part with, I'm sure, that would fill in the gaps. It's available as a research library for those of you who want to see the stuff that you remember from your youth and the incredible things. But please feel free to contact her and connect with her. It is probably the single surviving great reference collection of what we all gave our lives to.
Let me also mention that this is an inspirational panel because I suddenly remember that in my attic, I have the cover and the, I think, 3 interior pages printed already of comic art number, whatever the next number is. The story is by George Metzger. Wow. And the cover is by Von Bode. So maybe I should...
You get to work.
Yeah.